You're listening to The Sports Rabbi, hosted by Josh Halichman.
We're back here with the Sports Rabbi, Josh Halichman. Welcome aboard to the Sports Rabbi Show, Holy Land Hoops, where we bring you the best of Israeli basketball, all the way up north in Aria, down south to Eilat, and all the great cities in between, Rishon LeZion, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and many, many more. Today we go to the United States, and we have a great guest on. It is Pete Croato. Yes, Pete has a brand new book called From Hang Time to Prime Time, Business, Entertainment, and the Birth of the Modern Day NBA. We have a wonderful conversation about the NBA, especially in the late 70s, 80s, and 90s, talking about how the NBA became just that, the National Basketball Association that is so entertaining, that is so awesome, that is so wonderful, that brings us the stars of the stars. And it's just a fantastic conversation that we have talking about hoops. We talk about so many different subjects. It could be from Magic Johnson to Michael Jordan and many, many more. Larry O'Brien, the commissioner before David Stern, who brought David Stern into the NBA. We just have a great time. It's a great, 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 great talk that we have. Make sure you pick up his book, From Hang Time to Prime Time, Business, Entertainment, and the Birth of the Modern Day NBA. There is links to Amazon right here, so you can pick that up as well in this post. Also, make sure you leave us a 5-star rating on it. On iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you find your podcast. Also, leave us a good review. Make sure you check us out at The Sports Rabbi, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, sportsrabbi.com, for the latest and greatest news, both in English and Hebrew. We bring it to you both. We're the only website in Israel that does it in Hebrew and in English. Make sure you check us out. Pete Croato, he's up next. Enjoy the program.
You're listening to The Sports Rabbi.
All right, we're back with the Sports Rabbi, Josh Halichman. Welcome aboard to the Sports Rabbi Show, Holy Land Hoops. We're bringing you the best of Israeli basketball all the way up north in Aria, down south to Eilat, and all the great cities in between, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and many, many more. Today we go across the ocean all the way to the United States of America to Ithaca. Yes, Ithaca, New York. And we have a very, very special guest with us today. It is none other than Pete Croato. He is the author of a great book that came out just a number of months ago entitled From Hang Time to Prime Time, Business, Entertainment, and the Birth of the Modern Day NBA. And of course, in our podcast, you'll be able to purchase the book. I'll have a link for that and a link also to Pete's great Twitter account. So you can check that out as well. Book focuses on, of course, the NBA and just how it has become popular during the 70s and 80s, and really was the precursor to what the NBA is today, which is a business unlike none other. Obviously, a sports league that spans the entire globe. No other sports league launched in the United States, be it the NFL, Major League Baseball, or the National Hockey League, can come close to the worldly value of the National Basketball Association. And talk about all that and many, many more. And the cover is fantastic. That orange, you see the guy hanging in the air with the TV, the old time TV there from Hang Time to Prime Time. Pete Croato, how you doing today? What's going on, baby?
Doing fine, Josh. How are you?
All right, doing very well. You know, I loved talking to you off air.
Yeah.
Two of my most favorite people, Mike Francesa and Mad Dog Christopher Russo. The good old days of Mike and the Mad Dog, how much we wanted them back. But you know what was so great about them, especially listening to them in the 90s when they were in their heyday, Pete?
Yeah.
Was they loved the NBA. Out of all the sports, yeah, Mike was a big Mickey Mantle, New York Yankee fan. But really, the NBA was such a key feature on that radio program that went from 1 p.m. to about 6:30 p.m. in the afternoon. I used to listen to it sitting in my office in Manhattan. Every day, all day, it was on there to WFAN. But boy, when Mike and the Mad Dog came on at 1 o'clock, you knew that at 1 o'clock, you hear the Mad Dog coming on, giving the opening to the show. There was something to listen to because they always brought something new. And it was so often it would be the NBA. It would be Pat Riley. if it would be the commissioner, David Stern, at the time, if it would be Patrick Ewing or one of the other great players that would come on board. Now, you really take the NBA from before that time period and trace its roots to how it gets to that time period. That really makes Mike and the Mad Dog, really makes the way that we digest sports in today's day and age, Pete. And I think that that really, to me, was one of the biggest messages that I got out of this book.
No, I thank you. No, and that was my intent. I mean, I don't know if I think we're a lot alike in terms of our sports consumption. And I don't know about you, but I've read an unhealthy number of basketball books since I was a teenager. And whenever the 1980s NBA would come up or the 1970s NBA would come up, there was always this discussion of, oh, well, the league had this problem with television or drugs or race. But I never really knew or was never really discussed how the NBA got from that point to the point where it is now, where not only, you know, are Mike and the Mad Dog talking about the Knicks and, you know, whether they should trade for Derek Harper, but where the NBA is just, you know, everywhere. If you're a kid living in America, you know, when I was growing up, there wasn't, you know, there were only maybe one or two options to watch an NBA game. I mean, you had CBS Sports on a Sunday afternoon, or maybe you had a regional cable network like MSG or Sports Channel. But now it's just, you know, you can see the NBA anywhere, anytime. That has a lot to do with the growth of social media and television and all that good stuff. But it's just amazing to me how the NBA has just blossomed, as to how you put it, this global enterprise that has its fingers in every international pie. It was a topic that I'd always wanted to discuss or get into, as a reader, and I was lucky to get a chance to do that as a writer with this book.
No, definitely, and I think you really hit the nail on the head, and you really start off the book really tracing back to the, you know, the beginnings of the NBA that we know it, which is right before the time of David Stern.
Yeah.
And, you know, the only thing that a person knows about Larry O'Brien these days is they're presented with the Larry O'Brien trophy, right?
Right.
And everybody says, great trophy. And nobody really asks, who's Larry O'Brien? So you really get to the sense of who Larry O'Brien is. And I believe you interview his son for this book. Of course, Larry O'Brien, he himself is a very famous person in his own right with the Democratic Party. And I'm sure you'll talk a little bit about who he was and how he got involved. You know, he lived a very, you know, interesting life, to say the least. And, you know, when you look at his Wikipedia page, you see literally, you know, born in 1917 in Springfield, Massachusetts. How ironic, right? That the Basketball Hall of Fame, not the National Basketball Association Hall of Fame, but the Basketball Hall of Fame is based there, and died at the age of 73 in 1990. But so who is this Larry O'Brien?
Yeah, you know, he is somebody who was a It's hard to pinpoint just how big a role Larry O'Brien played in Democratic Party politics in America. I mean, he was a giant. I mean, he was on the cover of Time magazine in 1960 or 61, which gives you a sense of just how prominent he was on the national stage. But before that, Larry O'Brien was part of JFK's Irish Mafia. He was somebody who helped John F. Kennedy get elected in 1960. I mean, he had the playbook as to how he got voters, how he courted the public. So he really was, in a lot of sense, JFK's right-hand man, and helped him get into the White House. And then when JFK was assassinated in Dallas, Texas in 1963, Larry O'Brien was on the plane ride back to Washington, D.C., sitting next to the coffin. I mean, he was... And then when Lyndon B. Johnson became president in 19, shortly thereafter, he was part of his cabinet. He was the postmaster general. He was the chair of the Democratic National Committee mm-hmm. for two terms. So he was somebody who was a national figure in the 1950s and 1960s and even the 1970s. How Larry O'Brien got to the NBA is very interesting because the NBA courted him very, very heavily because he was somebody who was really on the downside of his political career. In 1974, he was out of politics. He was out as the DNC head. And he was somebody who was sort of biding his time. He was retired. He was somebody who was just going to Knicks games and watching basketball games like everybody else. But he was courted by J. Walter Kennedy, who was who was his predecessor, and by a lot of the team owners who basically begged him to take this job at the NBA. And what's remarkable too, Josh, if you think about it, is that. When someone is named the commissioner of a major sports league, that is their pinnacle. Like if you're David Stern, that was your career pinnacle, was to be the commissioner of the NBA. If you're Rob Manfred, you're the MLB commissioner is the peak. For Larry O'Brien, this was a step down to become an NBA right. commissioner. So it was a lot like, I'm trying to think, if Al Gore became the commissioner of, I don't know, like the National Pickleball League. Like it was a big step. It was a step down from, but he took the job because A, he loved basketball. It was his first love. He shot hoops at the Springfield YMCA. He was a Celtics fan. And B, he had power. The job allowed him to basically run the league as he saw fit. Yeah. So as he put it in his unpublished memoir, he bit the bullet and took the job. And, you know, but yeah, I mean, David Stern gets all the attention as NBA commissioner. He's the central figure in this book. But Larry O'Brien is prominent for a couple of reasons, and the least of which is his experience before he took over as commissioner. The first thing is that he gave the NBA prominence. He gave the NBA credibility because here was somebody who was this big deal in national politics, who was somebody who was in JFK's orbit, Lyndon B. Johnson's orbit. Now he's the commissioner of the NBA and he's not a homer. He's not somebody who grew up with the league like Morris Podoloff or Kennedy. He was somebody who was an outside figure coming in and taking over the league. And the other thing that he did was that he recognized David Stern's genius and hired him full time. Mm-hmm. And those two things figured prominently in the NBA's influence. And I really do think that Larry O'Brien is probably the most overlooked figure in the NBA's history. I mean, yeah, we know him for the trophy, but he did so much more than just lend his name to that trophy.
Right. It's really quite amazing. Of course, we're on here with Keith Corrado. Excellent book, of course, from Hang Time. Prime Time, you know, you get now that Larry O'Brien really is the commissioner mm-hmm. when Larry Bird and Magic Johnson enter the NBA, and Dr. J, of course, makes the move from the mm-hmm. ABA to the NBA. And you start having those great series in the early 80s where mm-hmm. David Stern obviously sees, boy, we have something here. And I believe he was in charge of really trying to clean up all the drug issues that the NBA had. You mentioned his right, you know, he was hired full time. He was the right hand man. And he was really groomed for the position. He came into the business as an insider, whereas Larry came from mm-hmm. the outside. So he really saw the nuts and bolts. And if you see the list of accomplishments that Larry has, it's tremendous. But you really see David Stern, who then has the vision and takes the NBA to that next level. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't want to skip too far ahead, but one of the things that I had a good time was, you know, the NBA Inside Stuff game. All the VHS tapes that came out.
Yeah. Believe me,
I had plenty of those tapes. Okay. And later on, DVDs and... You know, we all had them, right? I mean, we wanted to see the latest news and views, and we wanted to see a player like Magic Johnson with those no-look passes. We wanted to see Dr. J with those big-time dunks. We wanted to see Larry Bird shooting the heck out of the ball. And then, of course, Michael Jordan comes along, and we want to see Michael Jordan because Michael Jordan is Michael Jordan. And he sees that he can now create this absolute brand. So forget about being just a basketball league. He's now taking the NBA to a totally different level, Pete.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, Larry O'Brien absolutely let David Stern do all the heavy lifting. And there was that understanding in the NBA offices that David Stern was the man making all the moves, dealing with the owners, dealing with Larry Fleischer, who was the players, who's the Players Association head. But the biggest thing, and I'm glad you mentioned this, was the branding, was this concept of look, we're not a sports league, we are an entertainment league. So and when you're in entertainment. Entertainment is about stars. So television was geared toward creating stars like Larry and Magic and Dr. J. The videos were a key part of that because you're highlighting each play. You know, if you're a prominent player, you got a tape. There was a Magic Johnson tape, a Larry Bird tape, a Michael, three or four Michael Jordan tapes. Right. So David Stern knew that stars were going to drive the league, and that it wasn't just going to be about, oh, we'll enjoy this great team, which you can, but he knew that casual fans were going to gravitate toward the stars. And that was really exemplified with when the NBA moved to NBC in 1990. And, you know, where basically it was just the ads were all, you know, Ewing, Jordan, Knicks, you know, Bulls, Knicks, like it was geared toward individuals, toward stars. And NBA Insight stuff really ratcheted that up a notch because every episode was, oh, here's a feature on this star player doing something, you know, casual here. Let's get to know this star better. Here are these highlights. The NBA did a masterful job, and this is all under David Stern's watch, of giving casual fans like myself the highlights, giving them the good stuff as sort of a taste to enjoy the entree, so you will. And those entrees were games and playoff series and all that good stuff. So, yeah, David Stern was a marketing genius, and that was something that I think Larry O'Brien recognized and was more than happy to let David Stern do, because David Stern just had a vision for the NBA and what he wanted to be. And Larry O'Brien just didn't have that, you know, because I think he was more interested in being the leader, being the boss, than really doing the work to get the NBA into a new era.
Right. No, I mean, it's tremendous. I mean, again, you mentioned that he did the heavy lifting. He really did the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
And it's a matter of how he was able to see what he had in his hand and the stars. And I guess that's why in the 80s and then in the 90s, every team had their stars.
Yep.
I mean, I remember going to an exhibition game at the old Montreal Forum in the late 80s between the Philadelphia 76ers and the Washington Bullets.
Yeah.
And I'll always remember the announcer, who were the two stars? It was Sir Charles. Charles Barkley, of course, he was the big man. He scored over 30. They made sure to make sure he scored over 30 points. And Bernard King. I mean, Bernard King was still at that point, you know, he wasn't what, you know, he wasn't the Bernie and Ernie show from the Tennessee Volunteers, but he was still a powerful offensive player who scored, I think, 40-something points in that game. And you're sitting there and you're oohing and aahing from these two superstars. And I remember having Knicks season tickets in the 90s, and every team had a star. You know, you wanted to see the Portland Trailblazers. Well, you wanted to see Clyde Drexler. You wanted to see the Seattle Supersonics. Well, you're going to see Sean Kemp and Gary Payton. You want to see, you know, the list goes on. When Minnesota came into the league, well, you know, I want to go see none other than Kevin Garnett. I mean, this is going to be my guy. The Charlotte Hornets, well, I want to see Larry Johnson. And then, of course, the Lonzo Mourning. I want to see, you know, as you mentioned, it's the stars. Every team had a star. it's a little bit different today. When you look back, when you look at today's NBA, it's not such this star, I guess, because players move around. Even you have a LeBron who's played for so many teams at this point.
Yeah.
The players move around and you kind of attach yourself maybe to a player, and you may have five different jerseys over 5 years from that same player because he's played on five different teams. But back then, guys were playing and they identified so much with the teams. Well, I know if the Cleveland Cavaliers are coming in, you know what? I'm going to see Mark Price, Craig Ehlo, Brad Doherty. I'm going to see those guys play. Those are good players. And the NBA understood how to take that. And obviously they made the big move under NBC, but I'll always remember, for me, CBS was such a big part of my childhood in that, in the 80s. And I loved, and this is going to shock people that are listening to basketball right now, this podcast, but you know who used to do the games with Dick Stockton, who his partner was on CBS?
Oh, it was, oh, you're asking me? Well, I mean, you have Tommy Heinsohn, you had Billy Cunningham, Bill Russell back in the day.
Hubie Brown.
Hubie Brown in the 80s, yeah.
Can you think about that? Hubie Brown was already a color guy on CBS with Dick Stockton. I love that. To me, that was the best team. And could you imagine Hubie Brown is still doing games today?
Hubie Brown was doing games for the USA Network in the 70s. Like, that's how far Hubie Brown's broadcasting career stretches. Like, when he was out with, I think he had been fired by Atlanta, he caught on with the USA Network, and he was doing games for USA Network when they were the big wheel. I love Hubie Brown. To me, Hubie Brown is an NBA national treasure. I've talked to Hubie Brown a few times, and he is just infectious. And he's also super knowledgeable about the game and prepares more than anybody. He is as diligent now as he was when he was starting off, when he was doing games with Dick Stockton. And I love the CBS crew too. And I came of age more with Marv Albert and Mike Fratello.
Right, of course. Oh, they were great.
If you look at the old YouTube clips, or you go back and watch the footage, Dick Stockton was a hell of an announcer. Tommy Heinsohn was great, super excitable, and could barely contain his homerism tendencies when the Celtics were playing. Brent Musburger was a really good play-by-play guy, and I think it gets lost in the NBA's history on television is just how integral CBS was with portraying the product. Because I write about this in the book, starting in 1982, 1983, when Ted Shaker becomes the executive producer of the NBA on CBS, the show or the game coverage does a 180. It becomes like the graphics improve, the introductory graphics, the theme song gets better. That song gets a nice overhaul. You have the way that the games are structured are improved, because now you have a proper introduction with a lead in, and then Dick Stockton and Tommy Heinsohn kind of run down what's at stake. The camera angles improve. The halftime show gets a personality. I think it's Pat O'Brien doing Pennzoil at the half.
Right, that's right.
So CBS Sports really deserves a lot of credit for the NBA we see today. In fact, more than one person told me that when the NBA went over to NBC in 1990, the NBA went over to NBC and had like a list of what they wanted to do that CBS had done. Like, that's how important and how prized the coverage at CBS was. It's a testament to, I think, CBS and the talent there, that a lot of the people that were involved in those programs have gone on and done wonderful things. I mean, trying to think, there are a couple of assistants that are with CBS Sports doing the games. They're now, directing NFL games. Leslie Visser, right, is still doing sideline work for CBS Sports. Dick Stockton is still a voice with NFL That's games. So
quite amazing.
It's a tremendous amount of talent in that channel.
It's just amazing. I mean, I'll always remember late 80s. If it's, again, Pistons, great team, the Bulls trying to overcome the Pistons. And again, every team had their stars here.
Yep.
And that CBS graphic would come up. You have Dick Stockton and Hubie Brown after he was fired from the Knicks in those late 80s. And, you know, to me, that was Sunday afternoon playoff games. If it was a Memorial Day, if it was in the middle of May, you knew that it was going to be a big game. Of course, we're on here with Pete Corrado, author from Hang Time to Prime Time. Of course, new book that just came out. You'll be able to get that, of course, on through the website here, sportsrabbi.com. It's posted in this podcast loop as well. Make sure you pick it up. It really goes through the how the NBA becomes the NBA. And, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about those videotapes, right?
Yeah.
You know, being in Israel now since 2004, I've heard, and being so involved in sports, obviously, and basketball primarily, you hear some great NBA stories. And what I mean by great NBA stories, I mean the time when Magic Johnson came to Israel, the time when Dr. J came to Israel. And you hear all these great stories, and you hear about the videotapes. And I heard this also when I was in Greece right before the pandemic started, and I was sitting with Theodoros Papaloukas, who never ended up playing in the NBA, could have played in the NBA, was a great Greek basketball player for Olympiakos and then for CSKA Moscow, played for Maccabi Tel Aviv a little bit. And they all said, we all waited for somebody from the United States to come back with a videotape or to send us a videotape so we could see the players play. And again, they're talking about those Magic Johnsons and all those guys. So that is the start of the NBA now becoming this international product. And it comes from just those videotapes, because forget about being on regular TV here. I mean, occasionally there'd be a game on, but I've heard stories. Sometimes when I drive to a city called Beersheba, which is in the desert, which is about an hour and a half south of Jerusalem, I go through some of these roads, and on the way, you pass by a center that has hundreds upon hundreds of satellite dishes, huge, every size satellite
dish.
And every time I pass by there, sometimes I have a basketball person in the car, and they say, back in the 1980s, and there was about one TV channel, and we had nothing else. Well, we would all pack into the car, and we would come drive out to this place, and in that back office down there, we used to be able to watch the NBA games that they would they would let us watch. Since, can you imagine, we had to travel from wherever, get to this place that had hundreds of thousands of these satellite dishes, which who knows what they were looking at. I don't even know what they were looking at, but that's where you knew you could watch NBA games.
Yeah.
That was crucial. And I'll bring you to another point. When I was here for a year studying it in college, I was at Yeshiva, people are listening here, back in 91, 92, that was the year that Magic Johnson made the, you know, obviously famous HIV announcement, retiring from the game, stepping away. But that year in 1992, he ends up playing in the All-Star game. And a bunch of us here in Israel, all these American guys, we rented a hotel, like not a room, but a hotel, like a dining room. And we brought in this massive, those big old time huge TVs. And somehow they were able to hook it up to who knows how. And we watched that All-Star game. And there was hundreds of teenagers and people in the early 20s from every walk of life that came into the King's Hotel, which happens to be literally across the street from where I work from today. And we packed into this dining hall to watch this game. And it was one of the most incredible games, of course, because we're all rooting for Magic Johnson. You know, everybody wants to see him play well. But literally, those little videotapes creates this love of the game. And then you start seeing the Iron Curtain start coming down. And you start seeing some players starting to come over, like Arvydas Sabonis, which is obviously near the end of his age. Jonas Mačiulis that comes over as well. And then eventually Tony Kukoc, obviously in the later 90s comes over to the Bulls. But it's an incredible movement that within a decade, it has now burst into this international game.
Yeah. I mean, it's that's one of the most remarkable developments over the past, let's say, 30 years, or even 40 years, is not only the outreach of the NBA into countries worldwide, but also just now that is no longer, when I was growing up in the, even in the early 1990s, when it was a big deal or it was considered risky when a foreign player who didn't go through the American college system came to the NBA. So as talented as Tony Kukoc was, there was all this speculation of, he's from Croatia. I don't know. Like, this is, oh boy, like what are we doing here? Now there is, I would say half of an NBA roster consists of foreign born players. And there's, and this, the notion of a foreign born player, a player from Europe or wherever, coming over and being lesser skilled than their American teammates or their American competitors is hogwash. Like, if you look at the 10 best players in the NBA, five of the top 10 have to be from places other than the United States. Yeah. I mean, you have Giannis, Luka Doncic, Jokic, Embiid is outstanding.
Rudy Gobert
is, I think, a two or three time defensive player of the year. It's amazing. It's amazing just how what before was such a risk. Oh, this player is from Africa, really? Oh my God! It's now no longer looked at with the same trepidation. And I think that has a lot to do with not only that has everything to do with the NBA's efforts to expand globally, not just with the videotapes and the cable packages, but also with getting clinics and getting leagues into those spaces. Africa is now the latest area that the NBA is really targeting with its leagues and with getting ambassadors and owners to invest in the NBA internationally. So it really is amazing to just see how the game has really become more cosmopolitan. Mm-hmm. And not only that, it's not even that big of a deal anymore. Like when Drazen Petrovic was, I grew up in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. When Draz became a star, it was such a big deal, not because he was such a heavenly shooter, but that he came from this mystical place called Croatia. Really? What, this guy? He didn't go through the, he didn't go to a power five school, and he didn't, what happened? Now it's normal. Now it's like, oh, Joel Embiid, spent a year at Kansas, but he played in Cameroon. Okay. It's not a big deal anymore. The fact that Giannis came from Greece and was drafted high, I mean, it was surprising, but it wasn't earth shattering. And now that he's a star or a superstar, I should say, it's not as big a deal as it used to be. I mean, I think that's incredible. That's what's incredible to me is that the NBA is truly a global game, not just in terms of its reach, but in terms of who's on the court. That's incredible to me.
It's phenomenal. I mean, and literally it comes out of David Stern. I mean, as much mm-hmm. as, yeah. and so quickly, and that's when you think about it, how fast did everything move that you get to a point where the players start really coming over and, Petrovic was one of the first players
to come
over. Mm-hmm. Obviously he sadly lost his life.
Yeah.
And that horrible accident on the Autobahn in Germany.
Right.
Somebody that, played for the Portland Trailblazers, then the Nets, and was really became a star. I got to see him play at least one time for the Nets. Actually, I believe it was against Shaq, against the Magic, in the year that Shaq was drafted. There's another team, 90s, for example. Yeah. There's another team, for example, Shaq and Penny, right? You're talking about stars. It's every
team.
Every team had their stars. It all comes back to that. And then you see how it continues to open and players start coming over from, really all different corners of the earth, which is fabulous.
Yeah.
But the fact that it happened so quickly, and then you have, of course, the 1992 Olympic Games in Barcelona, and Jack McCallum obviously has a great book on that.
Yeah, it's a great book.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, spectacular book. But that really takes what the NBA has done and puts it out to, say it was out to, I don't know, 100 million people, and now it's out to 100 billion people. I mean, yeah. All of a sudden, they've now, you're talking about the stars are now, they're transcendent. They transcend the sport. Forget about being stars. That 1992 Olympic Games in Barcelona opened up the eyes of the world to now be able to have players like Giannis Antetokounmpo and players that are just coming out. And you said before, you look at the rosters, there's well over 100 players from...
Easily.
From outside of the United States. I mean, even Canada. Look at Canada. If you look at the Raptors, what did the Raptors mean to Canada? It meant a tremendous, tremendous amount.
Oh, it's huge.
You can't even... you can't even look at it. Vince Carter made an impression on so many youngsters. Look at the amount of players from RJ Barrett, who's developing into a great young player, to Jamal Murray, other great Canadian players that are just coming out. And unfortunately, they didn't, as a Canadian, of course, it was unfortunate that they did not make the Olympic Games last year. But you see what's going on is just, it's crazy. And that doesn't happen if David Stern isn't in that position, but it also doesn't happen if Larry O'Brien doesn't set the stage for it to happen. And that's what makes the world of basketball so big and so great. And as I started at the beginning of this conversation, it just blows away every single other professional sports league from the United States.
No, you're absolutely right. It's all because of a simple facet, which is that David Stern envisioned basketball as more than just an American game, and he saw opportunities internationally that other sports didn't. You know, the thing about the NBA, which is why you mentioned before that it changed, you know, it changed so quickly on the international scene. And now, you know, we're not particularly surprised when a foreign player does well in the United States. Is, you know, it comes down to one simple fact, is that the NBA has no tradition. The tradition is that it has no tradition. So that allows the NBA to do things and to take chances that other sports would find would be reluctant to take. I always look at baseball as the counter example. Mm-hmm. Baseball takes 3 years to decide whether to do something. It's so bogged down by tradition and with the national pastime and with the sport your grandfather, turned your father onto, who turned your mother on. The NBA has none of that baggage of expectation. So it can move quickly. It can make these decisions and do things that isn't going to shock everyone into writing op-ed columns or to offer, you know, boiling lava hot takes that this isn't the way it should be. The NBA's lack of tradition is why it's always going to court a new audience. Because there's always going to be somebody who sees a game for the first time and sees a different version than what their brother saw or their sister or their mother or their father. And it's going to be that way until it's no longer profitable. So the game is always going to evolve. But the problem with that is because it's so volatile in terms of change and in terms of who is popular and who is, who's in charge, the predecessors get forgotten much too easily. Mm-hmm. So Larry O'Brien, as time goes on, I'm afraid is going to become even more of a distant memory. Mm-hmm. And the same thing's going to happen to David Stern as Adam Silver continues in his career. And the same thing is going to happen to players. I mean, at some point, LeBron James is going to be discussed by younger fans the way that you or I might discuss George Mikan or Bob Pettit or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. he's somebody, they're a figure from the past who we don't really have an idea of what their impact is or was. So it's an amazing game to watch. It's an amazing game to write about. And it's a game that I think is always going to amuse me because it's always going to change and it's always going to be unafraid to change.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, Pete. Of course, we're on here with Pete Corrado, the author from Hang Time to Primetime, great book. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Who, you know, you interview how many people for this book?
Let's see. I did 315 original interviews. And I think all told, if you include interviews I did for previous stories that are based on this book or that were using this book, 350, 360 in that ballpark.
Well, that's quite amazing. You went to the Jeff Perlman school of
I did. No, and it works. Honestly, that works. You call everybody that you possibly can. And that has been my credo for years, and it works. It really, really works.
And it's tremendous. If folks, if you look at the back of the book and you look at the participants, it's like it's one after the next. Quinn Buckner, and I'm just like pulling names here, Walt Clyde Fraser.
Yeah,
David Falk, of course, the great agent. Alex English, one of the, in my opinion, one of the great players that should be on the list of 75.
Absolutely agree.
Bob Costas. I mean, you're talking about stars. We talked about stars, right? Alex English was that star. That star. I mean, he was a star.
Yeah,
I mean,
he was a star. Wanted to absolutely see. Absolutely. And he's a guy that unfortunately got kind of swept away, and he admits it. By the NBA's marketing glitz,
right.
You know, he was a great player, but he didn't have anything really fancy about him. He wasn't, you know, a ferocious dunker. He wasn't somebody who was, you know, going to finger roll and be acrobatic. But he was a great player, and again, he's one of those stars that, you know, I think if you're a basketball fan and Alex English came to your town, you wanted to see him, and maybe Fat Lever and Dan Issel. I mean, yeah, he was. And again, he's one of those forgotten stars, which is a shame because he was a phenomenal player.
Great player. So who was the one guy there, you know, one person you can pull out of that list that was like, wow, this was like so much better than I thought it was going to be. And I learned so much from this guy.
Oh, man, that's a good question. You know, it's funny. One of the joys of writing this book and reporting this book was just that everyone I talked to, with one or two exceptions, was great. They were all amazing. You know, they were thoughtful. They were eloquent. They were generous with their time. But the one person where I learned a lot from, oh man, you know, I'm gonna go off the beaten path a little bit. The person I learned the most from, or who really was amazing when I talked to them, was a woman named Barbara Ward, who is now a U.S. attorney. In New Jersey, in America. And she was an administrative assistant for the NBA for a couple of years in the 80s. And she worked alongside David Stern when he was a hotshot executive, Gary Bettman. She worked alongside Larry O'Brien a little bit. The story she had from when the NBA was in its infancy was incredible. And the thing that made me say, oh my God, was she actually broke down how the NBA came up with its fantastic tagline, which I never knew. And she told me the story about it. She said, you know, David Stern had this joke where, you know, he would go around the office saying that, you know, saying, you know, how are you doing? Oh, I'm fantastic. Oh, I'm fantastic. And eventually he would get to a point where he would say, like, you know, I'm fantastic is what I say when I'm bullshitting you. It's an unusual joke, but no, like learning how that was and learning or how that came to be and what it was like to work with Gary Bettman and who's now the commissioner of the NHL.
Right, of course.
That was, I mean, you mentioned before about the Jeff Perlman method of calling everybody, which people may say, well, that's crazy. You talk to 350 people. Well, yeah, it is ridiculous. But if I don't talk to Barbara Ward, who in NBA circles is, to put it politely, a nobody, I don't get those stories. Mm-hmm. If I don't call the person who was a PR assistant for the Mavericks in 1983, I don't get the story of David Stern being in the press box with his shirt sleeves rolled up, having coffee with the beat writers. So those people, the people that are maybe not the bold-faced names, are the ones that have the most, have the best memories, because A, they haven't been asked about it 1,000 times, and B, it was more meaningful because it was, it didn't become a mundane to them. It was maybe they were in the NBA for 3 or 4 years. It was a special moment and they moved on with their lives. So yeah, I mean, I think of Barbara Ward now, but if you ask me that question 2 days from now, I'll come up with another person, and 3 days from now, another person, because the NBA's success was more than just one or two people. And that's the one thing I learned writing this book, was that, you know, so many people played a role in this league's ascension, and so many people had fond memories of this league before it became the colossus that it is today.
Now, you also spoke to Phil Knight, correct?
I did. I spoke to Phil Knight. I did.
That in itself, and if you know, tell people who Phil Knight is. If they don't know who Phil Knight is right now, I don't know if you're in the right sport. But to be able to get to that, and you mentioned it in the acknowledgments, you know, how yes. you ended up getting into Nike. But Phil Knight, I mean, that's quite the get, obviously, at a time where shoes.
Yeah.
Start becoming a major piece of mainstream marketing tool as well, excuse me, for Michael Jordan and for the many stars after that, that we see today. What was that conversation like?
You know, it was bizarre because I didn't expect to talk to Phil Knight. Originally Nike When I went through the proper channels, Nike refused to participate because Michael mm-hmm. Jordan wouldn't decline to comment for the book. Mm-hmm. So after that, I was like, well, no, we're not going to talk. So when I talked to Phil Knight, it was very, I'm not going to say it was a little disorienting, because he was somebody who was just very, very, very ordinary. He didn't present himself with any airs. He didn't come across as sort of this business guru. He was just somebody who wanted to talk about, you know, kind of the good old days. And what was surprising, Josh, was that like he actually called me. Like I think I got a message from him or from his secretary or his administrative assistant when I was in the movie. I was at the movies one day watching Booksmart, and then you know I saw that I had a cell phone message. And yeah, I mean it was very unusual to just be able to talk to Phil Knight. A and B, to actually say, oh yeah, here's his cell phone number, just give him a call. Because usually when you deal with somebody who's in that class of CEO or mm-hmm. business leader or whatever you want to call it, there's like 9,000 layers to get to.
Right.
You have to go to their assistant, then go through another flunky. And then that flunky. So to be able to just, you know, call Phil Knight and just talk about, you know, trying to court Michael Jordan when he was about to leave for Adidas. Was going to leave. That was bizarre, but in a good way. It was bizarre in a delightful, delicious kind of way. But that just goes to show you that, you know what, like, take your shot. If you want to talk to somebody, give them a call. I mean, no one is, you know, the worst they can do is say no. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you don't, you know, you'll shoot or shoot. So that's anyone listening to this, if you want to try and talk to somebody for a story or for a book or try them, you know, if they say no, so be it. Go to the next person and see what you can get.
Wow. That's a great lesson right there, Pete. That's definitely a great lesson, especially for me, who's always contemplating writing a book and hasn't yet been able to pull up the guts to do so. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about that off air, but it's a daunting project.
It is, you know. But
I mean, how long did it take you to write this book?
I wrote and researched the book in about 16 months. I had the idea for it around like 2013, 2014. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, so from the idea stage to publication, 6.5 years, 7 years, in that ballpark.
Wow, long time.
Yeah, it was worth it. Yeah,
it takes time, and these things just take time. There's no shortcuts.
No, I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, I think you have to, I'm very lucky in that I'm able to write about things that I love, and I was able to do other write other articles and work on other projects while this was germinating. So that's the one thing I'd recommend, is that if you can write about something you love and turn that into a book or into the material for a book or into an avenue to write a book, it won't feel that it won't feel that daunting. Because yeah, you said, I mentioned, it's funny, I mentioned 6 years, 7 years, and it feels longer, but it never felt that long. It never felt that frustrating to me, because I was still able to do things that kept me interested and kept me intrigued. So I was able to, you know, write sports stuff for Rolling Stone and GQ and other places. And, you know, that kept me engaged and into it. Whereas if the only thing I had was the book, it probably would have felt a lot longer.
Well, I hear you. What are you working on? What are you working on these days, Pete?
Well, I mean, I have various articles that I'm writing. You know, I'm working on a second book proposal that I'm hoping to start shopping around in the new year, or rather in a couple of months. And yeah, you know, I'm just keeping myself busy with various other projects and, you know, and hopefully pursuing stories that interest me and intrigue me. And that's really the name of the game, is to get to the point where everything that I'm working on is something that I like, instead of something that I have to do. So mm-hmm. that's where I'm right now. And I hope I can write a second book. I've loved writing a first book. I've already thought of ways that I can make the process better and be a better reporter and a better writer. And so, yeah, I'm hoping to get a second chance at it.
There you have it. Where can people reach out to you, Pete? Where can they find you on social media?
I mean, Twitter is really where I spend probably too much of my time.
I think we all do.
Yeah, but it's a necessity. It's a necessary evil. At Pete Croato, which is P-E-T-E, C-R-O-A as in apple, 2 T's as in Thomas O. I'm always posting articles, things that I'm working on. I hope to have a few things up in the next couple of weeks. I'm working on some cool projects for various outlets. And I'm hoping that, you know, that they'll be out by the end of the month. But, you know, we'll see. This business is crazy. And so I just try and stay one step ahead.
There you have it. Pete Croato, awesome book, from hang time to prime time. Maybe the next book's going to be about Deion Sanders. Probably not. From hang time to prime time, business, entertainment, and the birth of modern day NBA. You can get it here at Sports Rabbi. We'll have the link for that. And of course, it's put up by Atria Books. It was a fun read. It was great having you on board, Pete. And hopefully we can do this again.
Josh, I'd love to. Thanks so much for having me. And thanks so much for reading the book. I really appreciate it.